Greg Herzog, welcome to Theatre Voice. We're sitting backstage at the Royal Exchange. It's about not even a week since Pete Postlethwaite died. And Postlethwaite was a man who worked in many fields and in many theatres, but he was particularly associated, particularly in the last decade, with the Royal Exchange.
Yes, that's right.
I suppose it must be difficult for you because you worked with him closely on two major productions here, The Homecoming, which in effect brought him back to the Royal Exchange in 2002. And more recently in 2007 with The Tempest, a beautiful, unforgettable production of The Tempest. Would you, I suppose, just share with us a few of your thoughts on the man and his work? In effect, perhaps we could start with The Tempest and just, I suppose, summon some of the memories you had of him at that time and what it was like to work with him then.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it was interesting. One of the great things about Pete was that when you decided to do a play with him, you really embarked on a kind of, you know, 1 year process, because you'd think about doing the play about a year in advance, and so you'd have the opportunity to really meet up and visit and talk and grow the production with him. You know, he's an actor who wanted to kind of prepare a role meticulously in that kind of way, and particularly with The Tempest, which is like an act of imagination from the start to finish. We used to meet up a lot, basically, whether he'd come and stay with me or I'd go and stay with him in his beautiful place in Shropshire where he lived. Which is lovely, because you'd sit and watch this fantastic kind of natural views and talk about The Tempest. And you'd grow the production. And I mean, it's fascinating because, I mean, his detail, he wanted to mine every detail, every moment, which I think is one of the characteristics of a great actor. But he was also kind of fearless and imaginative and eccentric. And for someone of his prestige, so to speak, to be as risk-taking, that was the amazing thing about him, is to find someone who wanted to take risks and be highly kind of imaginative. And that's how we grew the role. But I think probably if I had one thing I'd say about The Tempest, it's something I've been thinking about a bit. And when you do The Tempest, I think one of the first things you do as a director and actor, you talk a lot about Prospero's staff, you know, this idea of this magic, you know, what is magic in the play, what does it mean, how are you going to do magic powers, and what is this staff that he's going to break at the end of the play. And we talked a lot about what we felt the magic of the play was about, how you would do the magic, what it was about, and it was really actually in the end about a rather profound kind of human effort in terms of understanding and feeling that lent one certain powers of concentration and focus. And I remember after a few months of talking about this, he suddenly phoned me up one day and he said, "I'm very excited, I found something in the garden. I found the staff." And I went, "Really?" Thinking, "My God, the designer, you know, we're going to build the usual obi kem nobi kind of staff that you do for Prospero." He said, "I found it." And I went up there and he'd found this piece of wood, which he then, over a period of a few months, decorated in very personal ways with all sorts of wonderful little details, building up something. And that was the staff that he used. And when he just had it, it was him. It was an expression of him in that kind of way. And of course, what happened was that you couldn't break this staff, so we talked about that. And then it became apparent that all he had to do was to hand it to Ariel and something would happen to him, because that's what would happen to Prospero. But the fact is that staff was kind of Pete's kind of genius in a way, expressing itself. So the kind of link of that as an actor to create that himself is something that I think is just indicative of his craft, really. I mean, it comes out of long thought, but something really immediate and brilliant too.
This was a major role for him, the Prospero, and it was a role that was particularly, I suppose, significant to those who'd followed his career, which to some extent became rather magnificently diverted into film and to some extent TV. It was in a sense him claiming what was rightfully his, which was a major Shakespearean role towards what one assumed at that point was the midway point of his career. Did it feel like it mattered a lot to him that it all went kind of right? I suppose this wasn't an easy part, and I suppose some might have said, had he had quite the right preparatory work for it to really yeah. fire. What do you think? What do you sense? Were his sort of personal motives for taking
well, it was
it on?
An interesting one, because The Homecoming was his idea. He wanted to play Max in The Homecoming because he played it at drama school when he was 20, and now he was 60. He wanted to play it. So even though I knew the play and it was a play I'd been thinking about, that was really his idea. But The Tempest was my idea. He hadn't thought about playing Prospero, so that was quite interesting. So I think he probably came at it a different way. He had thought about playing Lear, he'd thought about playing Macbeth. You know, those are the roles he thought about playing. He never thought about playing Prospero. No one had ever said to him, "You're going to play Prospero." So I think we started from that position of him going, "Really? You want me to play this?" But the more You know, we talked about why I wanted to do the play, which I've been thinking about doing for a long time, but hadn't really worked out finally how I wanted to do it, partly because I think, you know, I suddenly realized Pete was really the Prospero I wanted to do it with. I think it was quite interesting that he approached it that way. So I think he was quite nervous about it. And I remember one time he phoned me up and I suddenly realized he was saying, I can't do this. It was that kind of conversation, because he said, I'm trying to learn this, because I said, you know, you need to start learning this a few months in advance. Something I learned from Tom Corney on Lear, you start learning these parts 6 months before you go in. And he said to me, and I was like, oh my goodness, what am I going to say? Because it's like he's really saying, you know, I can't do it, I can't do it. And I said to him, I said, you know, the thing about The Tempest, you know, I feel this as a director, is that if you don't sit down with this text in the right frame of mind that is completely plugged into what I think Shakespeare's after, you stare at it and it feels like the most terrifying thing in the world. You simply can't get a handle on it. It makes you scared, it makes you sweat. But if you're actually filled with what I think the play is about, then it suddenly becomes the most extraordinarily available thing. So I said to myself, but my only suggestion is, when you learn a line, just think like Prospero. You know who you want to be as Prospero. Think like, so you phone me up the next day, say, it's going like that, it's going like that, you know. So it was kind of like that, you know, it was a tough one. But I think by the time we got to rehearsals, we had a very good company. He'd been involved in some of the auditions, particularly with his daughter, Ariel, and Caliban, the family on the island. So, you know, he'd sat in with the young actors, they'd kind of boogied a bit with each other, they got to know him, he'd gone sensed about them. And I think he was very excited. We had a very strong company and I had pretty strong ideas about how we were going to do it. And I think he just felt very liberated in our space, because it was a production, obviously, the Royal Exchange. I think it's a beautifully Shakespearean space for various reasons. But I think he felt very free in that space to express. He didn't feel constricted by any ideas. He didn't feel like he was being boxed in that way. And I think once he started doing it, he was extremely strong in rehearsals. I mean, it was a completely creative surge, as I would put it, you know. Mm. So from that point of view, but it was interesting, that wasn't his idea. I think possibly of the last one, and you know, the later roles he's done, I think that might have been the one where that came from somewhere else.
Interesting. I mean, what was a sort of quite poignant hallmark of that production was its understated quality. I mean, it used very interestingly, beautifully, the kind of space for kind of sonic effect, and
yes.
You often got a sense that he could be incredibly hushed,
yes,
and quiet, and to some extent frail and vulnerable in the way that he, I suppose, increasingly became in his sort of in more recent years. But
yes.
Did you partly shape the production's quietness, if you want to call it that? I know it wasn't a quiet production,
yes,
in many ways, because
yeah,
it had noise and sound, but it wasn't a flashy production. It wasn't a very obviously extrovert production. He could often be very still and very contemplative. Was that a I mean, I suppose they welded together rather nicely, but did you shape the production really to his personality, do you think? Is that too...
Well, I think in the sense that I've always, you know, I've known, I mean, I'll could talk about this in a minute about how long I've known Pete for, when I first met him and everything, but I mean, for me, you know, Pete's always someone who's appealed to one's most imaginative impulses. He's someone who, if you work with, he's kind of going, come on, go for it, you know, don't have any fear about your wildest ideas. So I'll be perfectly honest, I mean, the production was very much, the whole way the production worked was pretty much my notion of things, basically. I was very strong about how I saw things, and I was imagining everything to do with my feeling about the Royal Exchange, where I've worked all my life. So it really became about, because The Tempest, I think, is almost the play that defines any theatre it's done in, because it is a play fundamentally about theatre and the art in a certain way. I wanted the play to be a tribute. It was, I think, one of our anniversary productions, but it was kind of a tribute to the theatre that I loved, really. So really everything about it was a distillation of what I felt about working in that theatre, and obviously sound was a huge example of that. And it came down to, I mean, a simple thing about the actual production, sorry, this is about my own interpretation, was to do with the mask. I mean, I didn't know how to do the mask for 5 years. I thought, I can't do this play. I don't understand which series is, Juno is. Every time I come to this part of the play, it's supposed to be something extraordinary. He has the most amazing speech, you know, Rebel's Hour ended afterwards, and I don't get it. It's just dead. So I talked about it with him, and it's interesting that he prompted me to go further, because I started to talk about this idea, well, I think it could be the rest of the company, and it's about lines about love that he's doing for his daughter. And I talked to him about this play I'd done that he'd known about Shakespeare I'd done when I was very young, distilled plays together to make a story. And but then I suddenly got this idea about growing it into the mask of Spirits of the Island, of getting the actors who played the roles of the Royal Exchange to record the lines. So you'd have this notion that the play was about the group of actors who always worked in the Royal Exchange over the years doing Shakespeare. So it became about Prospero Shakespeare and everything. But he kind of encouraged me. And the great thing about Pete, he kind of go, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I don't know. I think I might be. He'd go, yeah, that sounds interesting. Really? All right, you know, go for it, kid, you know. And I think that was the great thing about him, was he made you feel really imaginative. So in answer to the question, man, it was a production that was very personal to me in terms of the whole way it was conceived, really, the look and everything. But having said that, I think I always felt that what Pete would bring as Prospero, which to me was more fundamentally an idea of a combination of a man who had lived life and had experienced all the different contradictory emotions that I think Prospero has inside him, which are reflected in the other characters: anger, revenge, lust, spirituality. I think Prospero's contained all those inside himself. I think that's why he is a man who's capable of doing what he's doing. And I felt that, you know, Pete has the imagination and the emotion. He had the passion to be able to encompass all of that. And once he as an actor could find the emotional reality in what he was doing, he would embody in such a way that an audience has to connect with him, which particularly in our space they can, hence the quietness and the intimacy. I mean, obviously he didn't have to give an epic, massive performance. I think that was one of the difficulties for Lear that he had was, well, any actor has with Lear, is that problem about, you know, if you're a certain age and can you bang it out the way it's supposed to be? And can you do it like that? You know, it's that problem with that. But I think with our space, it's there as a given that you can be intimate and real, and the epic can be done in a slightly different kind of way. But I felt with Pete, it was the question of the feeling of Prospero as a character, because I know with Pete that once you found the truth of something and you saw him communicate that, his bond with an audience is extraordinary. Because I think he kind of related to life in a way that, you know, kind of embodied the way everyone really feels in a certain way. In that sense, he was the great everyman actor in that way. He wasn't someone you kind of adored from afar, thought he's a special, strange being. He kind of felt like someone who had lived like everyone has, but had the imagination to want to communicate stories and emotions in a different kind of way as an actor, you know. Mm-hmm. So I felt that was it, yeah, particularly that he was able to do that. And in our space, you can get very intimate. You can bring the audience right in, but then you can make them feel very epic, which of course Shakespeare does anyway. That's why it's a good Shakespearean space, really. You can go intimate and epic within the shape of one speech, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, this idea of him as an everyman. And I suppose what's fascinating about the what you call, I suppose, the actor's CV at the end of his too short life is that he did instinctively seem to work as he wanted to work, and maybe the film career helped that even more. The choices, this wasn't a Prospero done because it would look good or he felt it needed to be done at this stage in his career. He seemed to need to have value in each role he undertook, a kind of quintessential demand that this role he came together. I mean, you talked about knowing him a long time. Do you want to go right back to the first
Right back to the first time I met him was in Bristol when I was a young director, and this is, Lordy, 4 decades, no, this is over 30 years ago. Yeah, it'd be over 30 years ago, so I was just 20. And I was running a fringe company in Bristol. I had friends at the Bristol Drama School, and Pete had been doing this amazing work in Bristol. This is after he'd been at Liverpool, which of course was also amazing and very important to him, I know. But he was working in Bristol, particularly with Adrian Noble at that time. They were doing these really startling kind of classical productions, and Bob Crowley was designing, and you know, that's where Adrian and Bob Crowley kind of started off, was in Bristol under Richard Cottrell. And Pete was this amazing, I mean, I arrived in Bristol and everyone just said, there's this guy called Pete Postlethwaite and he's kind of in the green room, which is a club every night, and you know, he's got to meet him. And I went there and Pete was kind of surrounded by this entire community of actors. And basically what he was doing at that point was that a group of actors were trying to keep what was called then the Little Theatre in Bristol open. It was like a group, they were going to close this theatre. And Pete formed this company, people like Nigel Cook, Albie Woodington, Louis Jamison people, and did a whole season of plays like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Waiting for Godot and whatever to keep this theatre open. So there was a whole kind of movement going on. And he was just this incredibly exciting person, and everyone kind of gravitated to it. He created this kind of community. I say this because this is what he did in every building he worked in, you know, up until recently, you know, in Manchester. But the other thing that was interesting was that he was a mentor, and at the drama school at that time, apart from Miranda Richardson, Jenny Seagrove and Greta Scacchi and various other people, was one Daniel Day-Lewis, who was at drama school, Bristol Old Vic Drama School. And I remember going to see him in this production thinking, my goodness, who is that? And Pete and Dan had this very close relationship, I gather, because I think Pete had seen him and obviously thought he was extraordinary. And I'm not sure if this is absolutely true, but the apocryphal story is that when Daniel Day-Lewis was going to do In the Name of the Father, he said, there's only one actor who can play my father.
Giuseppe Conan, that is Pete Postlethwaite. And everyone kind of went, well, we kind of know who he is. Pete was a very respected actor at that point, but he wasn't, you know. And I think it was that film that really, the way Pete said, Dan very much released his film career in that way, but that went back to this relationship that was entirely to do with the theatre. So for me, Pete's always been a man of the theatre, and I think he got to the point with his film career. I mean, he said that pretty constantly when we did The Homecoming, where we wrote to various people about celebrating 25 years, and Pete absolutely got back in touch and said, let's have lunch. And I hadn't seen him for a long time, really. And he said, look, I really want to come back to the Exchange. I want to do theatre work. I've got to the point now, I've done my film, I want to play some very definite roles in the theatre. That's how I want to express myself, and I'd like to work at the Exchange, and I want to work with you. Because we'd known each other when I was a young assistant director at the Exchange. You know, he'd come on there after Bristol, so we kind of continued knowing each other. This is over 30 years ago in that way. And so it's kind of interesting. But the thing I liked about the fact was what I said about when Pete came into a building and did a play, it would be so electrifying for everyone in the building. Would be, not just the company of actors. He liked to create the company of actors. He was very much a company leader in the best sense of the word. But every night was like an event, you know. It was totally live to him. He'd always talk about the performance, not in a boring way. People would be coming in, you know, members of the public who hadn't seen him for ages. There was an entire kind of life around him, and he'd inspire an entire building. I mean, I can't, you know, the effect he had on our building during the Tempest was extraordinary. It was like, you know, all day things were happening, not in a showy way, but he was very, but I noticed that because when I went to see him during Lear in Liverpool, it's a different kind of experience, but the same thing happened with that too, and it's something he created, basically. He always wanted to create a very close company, but also a very, not obsessive way of working, but a very in the moment, being alive in what you were actually doing and why you were doing it. And sometimes, unfortunately, in the theatre these days, you know, the first thing that happens when you open the show is that everybody starts worrying about the next job, or is it going to go? So, you know, he was always there every night, you know, to really create something, and he did that. And all the years back, I was thinking about this yesterday, all the years back when I first saw him in Bristol, it was the same atmosphere.
Gosh.
Was there, I think.
And do you talked about being assistant director at that point. Yeah. Did you assist direct on productions that he himself was in? Or was
I
that
did,
not,
yeah. No, first thing, I mean, I joined the Royal Exchange. Literally, my first production at the Royal Exchange was assistant directing Adrian Noble on The Duchess of Malfi. And Pete came with Adrian to play Antonio, which was a very odd part for him to play because, you know, he'd been playing, you know, De Flores, he'd been playing Aaron Moore. So why isn't he playing Boesler? Why isn't he playing Ferdinand? You know, he was playing the good guy. And I always remember Helen Mirren's face on the first day of rehearsals, which was rather like, who is this guy? And he's kind of interesting looking, but he's not an Adonis or whatever. And then, of course, you could just see after about a few days when she saw what Pete was going to bring to the part. And that was the really, well, one of the really special things about Adrian Noble's production, which is a well-known production, was actually the relationship between the Duchess Antonio and the children was a genuinely strong, good relationship, which reclaimed part of the play, which is often seen as being a bit boring because the bad guys are more interesting. It actually, of course, made the whole play completely different as a result. So I was assistant director on that, and then through a rather complicated thing, Pete actually took over the role of Emperor Jones. It was interesting. It's a long time ago, from an actor who didn't quite make it to the opening night. So the last week, I was quite involved in rehearsing him, so we actually worked together quite closely at that point because we knew each other before. So I'd kind of worked with him as a young director. I mean, that's why many years on he said, I'd like to work with you, basically, because we kind of worked together all that time ago. So I arrived at the Exchange kind of at the time when he first came to the Exchange in that way.
Yeah. And he was playing, sorry, with Emperor Jones, he was playing the black
character.
Is that right?
What happened was he started off playing, I can't remember what the other guy's part is. There's a part, you know, the other part to the Emperor Jones, and the actor playing the Emperor Jones didn't quite make it to opening night for various reasons. It all went a bit wrong. It's a very sad story, really. And Pete, we had to, you know, could you take over? And so he kind of took over. And
was he playing a black role at that
point?
Yes. He was. So that was extraordinary in its own right, I suppose.
Well,
was it not,
I don't
was it...
know. You see, I think probably you're going back, we're going back a long time, maybe 30 years now. I mean, I think it was doable, I think, is the word I'd use. Yeah, I think not now, but and he would, you know, but then it was kind of, how do we say, the production, really. Oh, I quite fancy, I can play that part, you know.
Gosh.
And so went and did it, but I kind of ended up having to rehearse it quite a lot with him, so we actually worked together quite closely on it, you know.
I mean, just to rewind very briefly back to that, those kind of early encounters in Bristol,
and
what I suppose I'm kind of fascinated in them, there's a kind of mystique here, which is that what are the tools with which Pete Postlethwaite did manage to galvanise people around him or make a kind of very cohesive force? Because to all intents and purposes, he's a very, really quite self-effacing man, not a sort of fireworks kind of thespian, doesn't, wouldn't steal the limelight particularly. I mean, was he actually a kind of, actually quite, once he had a pint or two, quite a big raconteur and wit? How did he galvanise people, I suppose? Was there a way in which he always included people? He always made people feel welcome? Or was he more provocative than that, maybe?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I don't think he was provocative, but I think that he measured everyone up. You know, when you were with Pete, you kind of knew he was kind of throwing down a challenge, which to me was to be kind of imaginative and passionate. And I think that as an actor, because he was such a risk taker, I can't underemphasize, you know, how adventurous he was as an actor, you know, and this is really quite rare, I think. You know, he was someone who made you feel that, I don't know, it's like in Bristol, he's doing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, he's going to play McMurphy. I mean, he was, you know, in the kind of rebel, kind of rock and roll, kind of early 70s, going into the 80s, kind of generation that I was just, you know, born into. And so for me, you know, I related to Pete like I related to going to see The Clash in a gig or something. You know, it was that kind of idea. There was a kind of excitement with how he worked. And I think that's what he kind of did to people. He enjoyed life a lot. Yes, he certainly enjoyed a drink. He enjoyed partying. But he wasn't overbearing even in that. He'd be there and he'd always be twinkling and he'd be telling stories. But he kind of just encouraged everyone to be very, very imaginative and not to worry about anything. And to kind of see life, because he was a man of beliefs and a man of principles, not only about politics and about humanity, but he was also, I think, a believer in the kind of what I would call, you know, the rebellious work, which for me has always been the interesting thing, you know, that kind of idea about work. He wasn't interested in mainstream safety in that way. He was interested in, he loved great plays, but he wanted to take them and churn them into something else. And this is where I think the experience at the Liverpool Everyman, which has been really nice in the tributes, I think, you know, Bill Nighy and Julie Walters and all these people you're talking about, because he talked to me a lot about his very early days there with that group. And there was something extraordinary that happened in with that group of people. They had an attitude to doing plays and classics and new plays, which was really adventurous and really exciting. And I think he always retained that excitement from that original band. It's like the first band you're in. And I think he always had that idea that, you know, that spirit could be alive wherever he worked, and I think that's what he was bringing across, because they seemed to have no, I mean, he did a production of Widower's Houses. When I told him I was doing it, we had a long chat. He said, oh, I did that play, I said, really? And there's a picture he showed me of him and Bill Nighy actually in that. But then he told me about the whole production and how they approached it, and it was pretty wild, and, you know, it was really completely left field what they were doing. But they did the play, he loved the play, he knew it really closely. But there was a complete adventurousness in how they approached the thing. I remember seeing him in a piece at the, God, it was a really strange piece. It was a Canadian play. It was at the Everyman, and it was a new play. And the playwright had written things like, this scene opens with Herbie Hancock's intro to Live at, you know, 72, when he's playing Watermelon Man, and it's this thing. And the whole thing is done, timed to this track of music. And I forgot what Pete had to do. I think he had to slap himself 99 times to, you know, a piece of wild music. And that's what this was. It was like performance art theatre and a bit of gangsterdom thrown in. That's the kind of thing he did, you know, he threw himself into that. So I think it's that adventurousness he had in his early part of his career could always be carried over right to when I saw him in The Town, you know, that film where, you know, he comes in and I, you know, he was, you know, obviously pretty ill when he did it. But, you know, he could walk in and just give that amazing cameo in that, of this kind of Irish gangster kind of, and he just, I said, how did you do that? He said, well, I just turned up and I started cutting the flowers and I suddenly had an idea about how to do this. And I talked to Ben Affleck and he said, oh yeah, just go with it, you know, and I just did it. They just said, that's great. But he had this kind of jazz way of really kind of inspiring himself in that way. And I think he always had that creativity, that imaginativeness, and always kept it fresh. You know?
And Julie Walters on the radio as quoted as saying he defined edgy, or I think she said he invented edgy. I don't know, that sounds a bit too much, but it certainly, so that was a quality that to some extent maybe was more overlooked by mainstream commentators, that he really was a radical.
Yes.
And that edginess was, I mean, was it dark and dangerous as well as kind of fun and sort of wildcat?
I think that I think when he was younger, yeah. I think the early days I knew Pete, I think there was, you know, I think there might have been a sense that, you know, if you were partying, you might kind of not want to go all the way, you know, you might not want to be there at 5 a.m. And it was funny, I suppose later on I noticed when we were working together that he was very scrupulous about going home at a certain point. So you would actually kind of go out for a bit and, you know, I think it was what we were talking about, you know, you'd go out for him for an evening and all sorts of people would be coming up to him who'd either seen Brastoff or Jurassic Park, or he kind of covered the waterfront, usual suspect. But I noticed that he was saying, I'm off home now, kid, you know, and I kind of go, oh, that's good. He said, yeah, I'm going home now. And you kind of go, I think this is a man who's saying he knows he should go home at 10 o'clock, you know, as opposed to 5. So, and as a result, I think it was partly to do with that. And also because I knew he got up very early in the morning and worked very hard before rehearsals. He did at least 2 or 3 hours before he came in at 10 o'clock to rehearse. So he'd do early morning work, you know, and I think he went to sleep earlier as he got a bit older. So he was a little bit, but... I don't know, I suppose because in a way the kind of, you know, the experiences we had working together were pretty harmonious ones and everything. There, you know, a couple of times on the homecoming, because it's an edgy kind of play, where they thought, oh my goodness, he suddenly would kind of come up with something and whoa, you know, this is kind of quite. But I think as he got, I think as he got older, like most people do, I think he kind of, you know, was a bit mellower in that kind of way. And certainly, you know, and he was great company in that sense, you know. But I think partly because he decided he'd go home early at the right time.
Of course, the trick of the homecoming, one of the tricks, one of the interesting twists I thought that production had was that he was allowed to be a less sort of domineering, stereotypically tyrannical figure, which seemed to, again, mesh very nicely with the with the qualities that Postlethwaite did have as a man. I mean, was that something that I don't know, just a little bit about that production would be interesting. I mean, I don't know even whether did Pinter manage to see that, or was that?
No, he didn't. It was really sad. He kind of was coming, and then I got anyway, he sent a fax saying, "I'm terribly sorry, I've got throat cancer, I can't come." You know. So he sent us a really nice card, but he was going to come, because I was hoping he was going to come see it in the round. I just thought it would be interesting to him to see the play in that space, because I think it does change the nature, particularly his kind of work, quite a lot doing it in the round. Well, for me, doing the homecoming was a slightly more mysterious event, because I think it is doing Pinter. I mean, it is a bit like you just have to immerse yourself in something and kind of be open to kind of where the jazz is taking you. But I think Pete's thing was that... probably, I mean, I think his strength was the fact that he embodied a kind of genuine, passionate humanity, and therefore playing perhaps, you know, cold, absolute tyrants is something that he was never going to really do in that sense. He would always have to find the reasons or the humour or the strangeness of being that particular character. So I think apart from the kind of patriarchal thing, was obviously going to happen in a slightly more serpentine kind of way. And that suited him as an actor, because I think as an actor vocally, you know, he had a certain quality vocally. He didn't have a big booming voice, you know, and so he's not silly, you know, he knows that I can't pretend I'm Donald Wolfit or suddenly, you know. So I think that he would kind of adapt in that kind of way. And I think possibly one of the interesting things about Lear, and you know, then again, anyone who plays Lear, any actor who plays Lear, is, you know, what do you do? The first half, the second half, you know, can you play the tyrant? Can you play the broken man? And it was kind of interesting for me to see how he would play the tyrant in that kind of way. And I felt that, you know, as what happens, I think, quite a few actors with Lear these days, it's often the second half of the play that's stronger than the first half in that way. I think those kind of absolute patriarchal figures are quite hard to find these days. So I think he did kind of adapt it. But... I love the fact that there was a kind of I thought what he was very wonderful as is the homecoming was a genuinely rather creepily disturbing father who would kind of be one of the mates with his sons and kind of ooze in that kind of way, and I thought that was really interesting. And also he found the humour there, you know, I mean obviously most people would, but I think he genuinely understood Pinter's humour in a really interesting way, you know. And it was you know, I mean, it was great. I think the most interesting thing about for me with that was I think that because Pete was returning to the theatre and he was doing the homecoming, I think everyone kind of felt that, because Manchester's not a, you know, not a naturally huge Pinter audience, perhaps like London has, you know. So there's something quite interesting. I think a lot of people turned up to see the play, because we were obviously packed out for weeks with Pete in it, who really had no idea what they were going to come and see. And I think that for me was the most interesting thing, and also for him, was you really were playing a play that no one quite knew what it was about. And therefore, because Pinter's rearranging the form anyway, it became a very live, interesting kind of event, a lot funnier than perhaps in a kind of Mancunian kind of way that it might do. Whereas in London, I think when you do Pinter, there's a very received audience that's obviously turning up to see how do you do the play that, you know, is very attuned to Pinter in that way. There's just genuinely people turning up and no idea what they're going to see. Thought, oh, Pete Postlethwaite, the homecoming, that sounds like quite a nice idea. He's coming home, you know, thinking. And they really, you know, used to enjoy that. And it was quite an adventurous run in that way of performances. Yeah. I like that.
I remember him saying when I interviewed him here at the Exchange, and he was a fascinating interviewee, much more approachable than I'd expected, and full of sort of strange kind of poetical asides and references. Mm. And it was a proper, as you say, you kind of jazz interview to some extent, in that he would go off beat and off the track. But he remembered very vividly his mother coming to see the Duchess of Malfi here, and him asking her at the end, did you understand that? And she said, I didn't understand all the words, but I always felt I knew what you were saying. And that he'd held on to that as a kind of litmus test for what actors should be doing, particularly with an audience that, as you've just pointed out, might not be, you know, familiar at all with kind of received, regularly revived pieces of work. And did you feel that was part of the homecoming aspect of Postlethwaite coming here, that he did feel there was an audience that to some extent was underserved, or would be maybe more wary than audiences down south of classics, and he was absolutely committed to making those plays ring true to them?
It's an interesting question that, obviously, you know, he worked with us and he worked in Liverpool, and I suppose, you know, he didn't go to the National and he didn't go to the RSC or whatever. I mean, we never really I never actually talked about why that is. I mean, it's something that people would say about him, but it's funny that I never really talked to him. And of course, he did the, you know, Macbeth in Bristol too, you know, and, you know, which is also very important. I think he probably did have a sense of that. He was certainly very happy playing. He liked to play, you know, over parts of the country. He wasn't someone who had to appear in London. He didn't feel that was the be-all and end-all of existence. So I think that's partly what he felt. I mean, he did say to me that, you know, once that what he liked about the audiences we had at the Exchange was that he just felt like he'd go out every night and he was playing to people, as opposed to, you know, well, stupid to say tourists. I mean, that's unfair on them. But you know what I mean sometimes when that happens. Or indeed the London audience, which is often filled with actually people who are in the media kind of world, so to speak, you know, such a wide-ranging audience. And I think he really said, you know, I really like that because I feel like I'm doing my work with the play and testing it with the genuine people, and that's kind of what you want to do. And I think you're absolutely right that by doing that work, he certainly opened it up to lots of people who might not come to the theatre normally but wanted to come and see him do something. Mm. But the one person show he did, Scaramouche Jones, which is an amazing piece of work that he went around, you know, the whole, I mean, I saw that in about four different places around the country. And you know, he was more than happy being somewhere in Plymouth or being in Liverpool or being in Darling, I don't know, you know, just playing this play and going out and doing this magical 1.5 hour monologue, you know. And he was very happy being on the road in that way.
Mm. Mm. Obviously, have to come to an end. I'm sure people will be talking about him for years to come. One of the things that John Goodfellow, the press officer, said to me on the way into the interview was that, in effect, obviously the building was in mourning for him because everyone had somehow got to know him, felt they got to know him, but also that people from up the road, you know, that he kind of extended his largesse to the sort of nearest watering holes, cafes. People have felt connection with him. Is that, I mean, do you feel that was particularly the case with The Tempest, or that both times when he came here there was a kind of feeling that he kind of, outside even the theatre, he managed to make himself
felt? He did that. As I say, you'd go out with him and, you know, you would be going around different places and people were saying hi to him, and he kind of liked that idea of going down the street. I mean, he wasn't someone who kind of, you know, wanted to adore me, but he kind of always chatted to people quite clearly. I think there was a difference. I think somehow doing Prospero, probably in the way we're talking about the role and everything, I think there was something about embracing everything that he probably was kind of doing. He certainly had an amazing capacity just to be around the building. And you know, he had this thing of, well, you know, the door of his dressing room was open before every performance from about 6 o'clock, and you just wandering and chat to him, and he'd always have kind of Bob Dylan's Modern Times playing on Johnny Cash's latest album. And yeah, everyone would come in and have a chat. I mean, I did hear that, I mean, I'm not sure this is absolutely true, but I did hear that he would kind of see everyone in the cast before the performance and kind of have a little look with each other before he went on. It was something everyone did, like every performance, except for Ariel, because no one knew where Ariel was at that point. He was somewhere else in the building. And I think he had that capacity. And certainly, yeah, the Chop House down the road for The Tempest was famous. I mean, there's a picture up there, I think, of Pete and his friend Eamon Boland, who was in the production, Russell Dixon, who were all together in Bristol like 35 years before, and who were all in the same company. And they did actually have a table which had a plaque to the Duke of Milan and his bastard brother, you know, drank here. So there was actually a special table, little plaque, where they used to have the beer. That seems to have gone now. But that's where we had the rap party and everything, because he knew everyone there and they threw over in the pub for us. And so he did do that, yeah. But you certainly got a feeling with Pete, I mean, this whole idea, but you'd be in the country with him in Shropshire and, you know, he'd do that thing, he'd be driving along, he'd always talk to everyone and everyone knew, and he just had that way with him, with people. He liked to, in a very unpretentious way, in a very un-celeb way, just kind of connect with people all the time. He seemed to feed off that very strongly. I was amazed at how much he, during the run of attempts, there'd be all sorts of people be coming to see him, wanting him to talk to their children about stuff, people he hadn't seen for 30 years, just kind of talking to him. And he just had this very easy relationship with them all. And they'd, you know, he'd come up to the dressing room, he'd just chat to people and just be very quiet about it. But it was something that was part of the whole process of the work for him.
Yeah. You know. Just very sort of almost finally, Miriam Margolis was on the radio again talking about working with him on Romeo and Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann film. And she said that everyone deferred to him, even Baz Luhrmann, kind of, because he had this wisdom and he had also an extremely closely kind of worked knowledge of Shakespeare. I mean, I don't know at what point actually it becomes difficult to defer to an actor. I mean, obviously he had an extraordinary charisma. Did you must have been, when you first met him, to some extent maybe even in awe of him as an early young assistant director. I mean, by the time he came back here, I suppose, was it very clear, you know, who would give the final word on something, I suppose, between you on a play as dominated?
Well, it was interesting, because I suppose when I knew him in Bristol and when I knew him in Manchester, I mean, although he was highly respected as an actor, he wasn't, so to speak, a star, which he was when, you know, we worked together later. No, he kind of, well, I think this is to do with how you direct, really. And I mean, when you're certainly working with someone as extraordinary as Pete, but no, there wasn't that. He didn't do any of that on The Tempest. That was my thing, basically. I mean, he knew what I was going to do, and I mean, he kind of understood. And sometimes I had to convince him. I mean, he was very unconvinced when I told him that he needed to take his clothes off and to put on a blue suit at the end on stage, and he just took a long time to accept that we were going to take the time to do that. And I said, just please do this, you know, I think it's really important. And then he kind of did it, and he suddenly looked at me and said, oh, I see, yes, you know, right, okay. You know, he could have said, I refuse to do this, then we might have had that conversation, but he wasn't about that. I think he went with you. I mean, for me, with Pete, it's one of those things where I think you, if you're working with someone who has that aura and that reputation, is that if they're encouraging you to be as creative as you can be and you just throw everything you've got into it and they go with it, then that's good. You know, that's what they're doing. And that's what happened with us, luckily, on those two. You know, we were going to work together again and it might have been different. But we always, in a way, you know, he was very supportive that kind of way. But he did fancy himself as a director, I may as well tell you. That's another story. But he certainly fancied himself directing too. That was
You just momentarily said that you were going to work on something with him. Was a project actually promoted? Was that?
No. We had it in the works. I mean, we were going to do Death of a Salesman, Willie Loman, which I think would be wonderful. And we've had it, we had it planned for about the last 3 or 4 years, and literally every year, you know, it started. Well, anyway, you know, a couple of years ago, we were about to do it, and then he said, no, I've just got to go and have a bit of a... And then, you know, it kind of went from there. So we never managed to get to it. We talked about it a lot. And it was the play, actually, we talked about when we first talked together quite a few years ago, but it had just been done in the area. So we finally had it revived. And I mean, it's a play I've done before here, but I'd love to have done that with him. I think that was a part he'd have been great in, Willie Loman. I think he'd have been a very powerful Willie Loman. And you know, it's a play that should always be revived anyway, in my view, so...
And what was your, there are two final memories. What was your first, you talked about sort of being told to go and find him out, seek him out. Do you actually remember an initial conversation with him, or him registering you for the first time back in those, when was this, 1970?
Ooh, 78, 79, somewhere in Bristol. No, I mean, I think all I remember was, not really, the thing I remember was a very smoky filled room. It's called the Green Room, and it was a club, so you know, everyone was, you know, and all I remember with this, with that face with those eyes and the kind of twinkle and a thing, and you know, it was quite late on in the evening, so you know, things were definitely well on. And I remember just, you know, saying hello, and he go hi, and he just looked at me briefly, and you know, that was it. We didn't have a long conversation. It was just like, oh right. And then I just kind of sat there and kind of watched him in motion for a bit, and I went to see all the work there. So we didn't really know each other that way. So I suppose you know, it was when he came to Manchester that first time. Then we obviously talked a bit more. Yeah.
Mm. And if you have a sort of ingrained memory, or a memory that will most comes to mind when you think of him, or in the last week, I suppose, must have done a lot. I mean, is there a particular vignette or scene that comes to mind where you feel, I don't know, was it actually on stage, or maybe it's off stage, where you felt that's the thing that defined him for you, I suppose, or defined your relationship with him at least?
Well, he gave me the staff at the end. He said, you have it. Yeah. So I still do. That's what, you know, so I still have that there. I mean, it's there at home, and I've been looking at it quite a lot recently. And,
yeah. Yeah.
So I suppose it was that. That would be a personal thing. I think for me, the particular moment for me in the Prospero performance was the whole idea of what the epilogue speech was about, and what the ending was about, and how he would do that, and how he would leave the theatre. And literally the island was simply defined by quite a lot of sand at that point, but he found this wonderful moment of literally stepping off it. I mean, we had this idea at the end of Prospero, went back to Milan, like we all leave the theatre, so I wanted to hear the footsteps right out to the St Anne's Square box office receding into the distance, which on most nights, if someone didn't applaud, worked, you know, but literally the audience would stay very quiet and they'd just hear these footsteps going into the darkness, which is where they were going to go in a minute because the play was finishing. But he found this moment particularly where he stepped off, so to speak, the island in the theatre, and that was extraordinary, you know, right at the end. He just found a way of doing that was entirely his. So I think I kind of remember that. It's a piece of genius, yeah.
Mm.